We are going to continue our deliberations with the discussion of the PIR of IFRS 10, 11, and 12. Filippo, you're going to introduce?
Okay, thank you. Good morning, everybody. The purpose of this session is for the staff to report back on the activities we have conducted and the input we have received so far in phase one of the post-implementation review of IFRS 10, 11, and 12, and then we'll ask ASAF members for their views. So, since September, the staff has been engaged in phase one, which has involved meeting a number of stakeholders to ask their input in order to inform the discussion that the board will have about the contents of the public consultation. So, we have met around 20 groups of different stakeholders, and the PIR has also been on the agenda of the Interpretation Committee and the other consultative groups. And if you want the full list, you can look at it on slide 4 of agenda paper number 3. The current plan is that the staff will report back to the ISB board in February with the analysis of the input we have received and our recommendation for the content of the request for information. I think most of the people around this table are familiar with the process of a post-implementation review, so I will not go through it, but of course we are happy to take any question at the end of the presentation. So the SBJ has kindly offered to report back on the summary of the input they have received from the AOSG members. So I will leave them the floor, and then after that, Jen will report back on the additional input we have received from stakeholders. And then we'll move on to the questions for the ASAF member. So I can give the floor to Rieko.
Thank you. I'm going to give you a summary of the comments from AOSSG members on IFRS 10, 11, and 12. Based on the request from ISB staff, we asked AOSSG members to provide preliminary comments on IFRS 10, 11, and 12. Initially, we asked the AOSSG working group members, and then we discussed the comments at the AOSSG annual meeting in November. Today, I'm going to explain a high-level summary of the comments indicated on slides 6 to 10 of Agenda Paper 3A. Detailed comments and examples are included in the appendix of the Agenda Paper 3A. In addition to the comments and examples in the agenda paper, I provided some other examples and comments to ISB staff separately. In reference to IFRS 10, as indicated on slide 6, many members noted that overall, IFRS 10 provided useful information to users. However, several members asked for clarification of the five concepts indicated on slide 6. They commented on difficulties they face when they apply those concepts in practice. Moving on to slide 7, some members noted that IFRS 10 included explanations and examples. However, they said that general principles were not very clear. The general principles in making decisions related to the concepts of relevant activities and potential voting rights were not clear. Some members commented on the so-called corporate wrapper issue. They are concerned that IFRS 10 was relying on form over substance. They were concerned about different outcomes, even when the substance was the same. Some members expressed their difficulty in making the assessment in a timely manner. They said it was difficult to make the assessment in a timely manner because the factors to consider were out of the control of the entity. Therefore, it was difficult to conduct continuous assessment. With regard to remeasurement of the retained interest when control was lost, some people said remeasurement did not provide useful information because nothing has changed for the retained interest. Moving on to slide 8, in relation to the accounting for changes in interest. Some members said IFRS standards did not cover all patterns of changes in interest. The table on slide 8 shows possible patterns of changes. The accounting treatment is not clear for some patterns. That's a summary of the comments on IFRS 10. Moving on to IFRS 11, as shown on slide 9, many members noted that overall IFRS 11 provided useful information to users. Several members raised issues related to the equity method. As a general issue, clarification was requested on the underlying concept of the equity method. In connection with the ISB's primary financial statements project, some people commented on their tentative decision, which is to distinguish between integral and non-integral equity method investments. They said it was not clear whether the tentative decision would change the scope of investments that are currently accounted for using the equity method. Also, many of the comments on IFRS 11 were consistent with the comments on IFRS 10. That's the summary for IFRS 11. With regard to IFRS 12, as indicated on slide 10, many members noted that overall IFRS 12 provided useful information to users. However, several members stated that it was difficult to determine what information should be provided. For example, the concept of material to the reporting entity was unclear. Also, several members commented that the benefits did not justify the cost of providing the information for someone without disclosure requirements. They believed that some information required by IFRS 12 provided limited benefits to users. That's a summary of the comments from AOSSC members. Now I'll hand over to Philip.
Okay, thank you. And we can hear some other comments from other stakeholders now.
Thank you, Rico. Thank you, Philip. Good morning. Slide number 5 to slide number 12, our agenda paper 3, are feedbacks from our meetings with different categories of our stakeholders. Generally, stakeholders say that the standards are working well in practice. Most stakeholders are fine with the principle in IFRS 10 and think that application is generally satisfactory. Most stakeholders understand the application of the standard requires judgments to some extent. They also believe in no way the board should remove these judgments. Some stakeholders recommend the board to consider if there are ways to clarify the application of some judgmental areas. Some others request more information to be provided. Let's start from IFRS 10. RICO has mentioned the identification of the relevant activity. This is the case especially when involving estimation of the likelihood of occurrence or non-occurrence of future events. Some stakeholders also experience about the separation between protective and substantive rights, which is also mentioned by RICO. And the next one is control assessment with less than majority of voting rights. This issue has been mentioned by different category of our stakeholders. Some are concerned about assessment of control when the investor has less than majority of voting rights and other shareholding are dispersed, so-called de facto control concept. Some questioned how to apply paragraph B18 and B19 of IFRS 10, which include factors and indicators to be considered, for example, special relationship with the investees. And assessment of a relationship between the investor and other investors, so-called de facto agent relationship, also is a challenging area to apply in practice. Stakeholders are requiring clarification in these areas. Some stakeholders request more specific requirements on principal versus agent analysis, in particular, how to determine the magnitude and the variability associated with the economic interest held by the investor when the sharing structure of returns is complicated and subject to what happened in the future. Generally, stakeholders say they welcome the investment entity exemption and find the information provided by fair value measurement more relevant than that is provided by full consolidation. However, some stakeholders think that the criteria to identify an investment entity may not be rigorous enough and leave room for some entities to achieve their preferred outcome by choosing to or not to apply the consolidation exemption. Some stakeholders express their interest in receiving additional information regarding a multi-layer group whose parent is an investment entity. Specifically, they asked for more information of an intermediate subsidiary when it is an investment entity itself, and therefore, according to existing requirements, measured at fair value by its investment entity parent. Stakeholders noted that information about the underlying investment held indirectly by the intermediate subsidiary and other financial information such as cash balance and borrowing used to finance investment has been obscured by the fair value measurement for the investment for the intermediate subsidiary. To address this matter, some stakeholders suggest full consolidation instead of fair value measurement, some, if not all, of the intermediate subsidiaries. The last point for IFRS 10, accounting for transaction with changes in ownership interest, which has been mentioned by Rico, we also noted this comment in a few times from our stakeholder. Let's move on to IFRS 11. The first matter related to the scope of the standard of IFRS 11. Stakeholders asked for accounting requirement for collaborative arrangement or risk-sharing arrangement when there is a no joint control can be identified, and therefore IFRS 11 cannot be applied. However, some stakeholders believe the economic substance is similar to joint operation. Some stakeholders noted the application of other facts and circumstances criteria in classification of a joint arrangement burdensome and ask for clarity in this area. Another focus area of IFRS 11 relates to accounting for joint operation. For example, stakeholders ask for accounting requirements when the output taken by parties of a joint arrangement is disproportionate to the interest held by each party. And another matter is the accounting for the lease liability by a joint operator when the joint operator signed the lease contract with third-party lessor on behalf of the joint operation. We didn't hear many comments on IFRS 12. Some stakeholders are interested in how disaggregated information disclosed should be according to the standard, and others are concerned about identification of a structured entity when applying the disclosure requirement. The staff think that some of these comments are already addressed by existing requirements, so that we need to investigate more. Is this a problem with the requirements or instead a lack of a compliance with the standard? We also receive feedbacks about additional information needs, such as more granular information on asset liability in subsidiaries, joint ventures and associates, especially when they are significant, the composition of NCI, and more information on how material NCI impact operating cash flow, etc. Now, I will hand over back to Filippo for the questions for today's session.
Okay, so the question we have for you are on slide 10 of agenda paper 3, and I think that we like to hear not only about specific issues with detailed requirement, but also general comment about how you think that the standards are working in your jurisdiction. So we can start first with the overall comments about the experience with the standard, and then you also have comments about the detailed requirement.
Roberto?
Yes, these standards are working relatively well. Of course, there are areas of confusion, area which needs clarity. We will talk later, I understand, of this. The main problems are within IFRS 11 rather than IFRS 10. And I don't want to repeat what has already been said before, but especially for separate or individual account financial statement, IFRS 11, it's a big problem because if we apply IFRS 11 as it is written on an individual separate financial statement, we end up having a sort of consolidation, I mean, proportional consolidation, and people believe that this is not portraying the reality in the individual financial statement. It should be treated as an investment. A joint operation should be treated as an investment.
Okay. Linda.
Thank you. I'll start out my comments by saying that when 10, 11, and 12 were implemented, I was not the chair of the Accounting Standards Board. I was actually implementing. So take that as given that I kind of have two hats on when it comes to this topic. So we use as a gauge on these things, as one of our gauges, is how many times we've had to discuss a particular item at our IFRS discussion group where we discuss implementation issues. So to start out with, I would say zero times we discussed IFRS 12. So putting that to the side, we don't seem to have any particular problems with IFRS 12. So let's go back to 10 and 11. The first thing I would say is a particular problem for Canada, and I'll say this now as opposed to later, was that we went a year before certain other jurisdictions went. We went in terms of the ISB's effective date. And what happened as a result of that is in the year after we went live, the audit firms came back to us and they had slightly morphed some of their views relative to certain provisions. And so we had stakeholders, myself included, revisiting accounting conclusions that we had already made and embedded in financial statements the year before. So I will put in my one plea here for common global adoption dates and maybe later too. So from an IFRS 10 perspective, while we found that we had to make significant judgments with regard to that standard, what we saw there was in 2012, there were three topics that came to the IFRS discussion group, and then nothing until one topic came up in 2018. By and large, stakeholders are relatively comfortable now with IFRS 10. They agree that some of the issues that you have raised are consistent with issues they'd like to see dealt with. But generally speaking, they're working their way through things and don't really have a lot more to add other than the issues that you have already identified. But we would support having those issues looked at in terms of implementation review. So then, having dealt with 12 and 10, we come to IFRS 11. And in particular, on that one, we had a lot of issues in Canada. And we saw that one discussed a total of 9 times, and rather consistently. 2013, we had a whole bunch of issues. 2014, we had a bunch of issues. It kind of just keeps going on. It's the gift that keeps giving. And so from our perspective, there are quite a number of things that we think, in addition to the ones you've raised, we do have some additional items, which I'm happy to give you. I've got a detailed appendix, actually, which I can give you and leave with you. But they, briefly speaking, there's the treatment of another party to a joint arrangement when it's no longer considered a joint operation. So that fact pattern. Whether an entity should remeasure its retained interest in the assets and liabilities of a joint operation when the entity loses control of an asset or group of assets. So that's another one that was discussed. The classification as a joint operation or joint venture and how the arrangement is structured. So that came up again several times, actually. And then there's the contractual arrangements test. And I've got a detailed appendix, which I'm happy to share with you.
Okay.
So by and large, what we would say is while people are quite, you know, working their way through things, we think in particular IFRS 11 has some problem areas, and we would welcome the PIR and welcome participating in that activity.
Okay. Can I just ask a follow-up question? I understand that most of the issues around 11 are joint operation accounting related.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that's true, Filippo. Okay. Yes.
Anthony?
Generally, I think not a great deal of problems with this. Other than the ones already raised, really. I mean, I think in the UK, our cut report and review enforcers of IFRS picked up on a few consolidation concerns of last couple of years. But at the heart of it, this standard, the IFRS 10 works well when it's easy, which it is for most of the time, but it's a challenge when it's a challenge because the transaction is complicated. And I think I would just, I think it just leads to a sort of note of caution that it's bound to be challenging because that's what it's trying to deal with, a complex, challenging situation, and trying to draw a line between in a very grey area. So, so I don't think it needs a radical change. I think it is just times when, because of the big list of indicators around control, it can become, you get diversity of views about which indicator takes priority in the relative weighting. So I think looking at that just to, with some care, but again, you know, I stress, don't be too quick to change it because it will just, it is just a very different way. I think the other one that is picked up on is just to make sure that through all of these indicators, the general kind of philosophy is really to get to the substance. There's one or two bits where it does feel like form, where the nature of the entity, the legal structure, suddenly kicks in both 10 and 11. And that does sometimes jar, I think, in reaching perhaps the true substantive position, because you have this these odd form lines, and I think it's on a conceptual level. I personally struggle with that. It's not something I've really heard from stakeholders, but it does seem to get in the way, as I think the SBG picked up as well, in terms of really finding the substance, because there is the odd legal form element, and I think that does happen in particular with the joint operations as well. And then on the investment entity, we have also had situations where stakeholders have identified a lack of information, particularly around the financial liabilities, the leverage that's been used within the bigger group in order to fund the investments, and it isn't really meaningful information for that to only be affecting the fair value, rather than being shown as part of the financing of the investment entity in order to bring about the purchase. So I think there is an information shortfall there at times where the leverage isn't properly shown. And but other than that, as I say, I think I'll add no more to what others have said. It works generally well, except when it gets tough, but that's what it's there to try and deal with these very difficult grey areas.
Alexandru?
just one comment here. I generally corroborate the other comments about the standards working relatively well. One thing of people are not very comfortable in the region is they're accounting for an investment when you lose control of the investment, but you keep the investment in another form. For generally, I control a given entity, but I use that entity to pay in capital in another entity, so I create a new entity, a joint venture, etc. But I haven't sold it. I haven't disposed of it. I'm still in the business, but I had 100% of entity A. Now I have 30% of entity B. But I'm still in the business. I'm not selling anything. I'm not disposing anything. So, and then to have to fair value the whole thing, with the impacts on dividends, capital, and everything else that comes with it.
It's proving not to be useful information because
the entity is pretty much holding the investment as it was holding before. So held to maturity kind of attitude continues to. So that part is just creating more distress and about those fair value calculations in those situations, and people don't think that provides anything good. Actually, investors are pretty much excluding that fair value valuation of anything they're doing.
That's an interesting comment that we heard also yesterday from the SBJ, but I'm saying it's interesting because so far in all the outreaches we had, I don't think anyone had mentioned that. So it's something new from yesterday. So, sure, when the standard was issued, the disposal draft was issued at the time, it was a new thing because before we were not remeasuring retained interest. But it's interesting that as
because
we have not heard that.
What happens, at least in our experience, I have a entity with several business, and it takes one of this of its business and forms a joint venture, for example, to explore it in a given way. And that gives you, not the right, but gives you the obligation to revalue the fair value of its existing business, which is counterintuitive in the sense why this information is relevant. If that information was relevant, you should fair value the other business as well. Just because it's a new arrangement doesn't change it significantly.
Understand. That's the point. Is it specific to contribution of the business, a subsidiary, to a joint venture or associate, or also apply to dispose like 60% of it?
Your first option is just when because when you sell it or you do anything, you lose control, but you are not involved on it. But when you lose control, but you continue in the business, you continue holding. You're not 51% anymore; it's just 35% now. But you're still holding the business. You're still collecting the profits of the business, and to revalue it at fair value doesn't seem to make much sense. But people didn't realize that when the standard was issued, they just think that it made all the sense at the time, but now they're in the practice of it. They just don't see that information as being relevant.
Vic?
We concur on 10 and 12. I think we concur. Most of the questions have been identified, and it's a matter of fine-tuning in most cases. I would only maybe put the emphasis for IFRS 12 on the need for a better description of minority interests, because at the moment there are a number of questions related to the understanding of minority interests. So fine-tuning for 10 and 12. On 11, many question marks. You know, I wouldn't say it is the bone of contention, but it's not easy. The end of the proportionate consolidation following the convergence project with the U.S. Has created a number of issues at the moment. The feeling is that the level of information provided via 11 is not satisfactory. Not easy to solve, though, but that's more crucial, probably the most crucial element to consider in during the PIR.
Chiara here. When possible, I would like to comment.
Go ahead, Chiara.
Yes, thank you. We discussed this subject with our consultative forum of standard setters early this month. The impression is that the members are starting only now to assess these issues, so we don't have a complete list at this stage. But the concerns that were mentioned were very much aligned with the presentation that Filippo has prepared. And in general, in terms of big picture, there was the same concern mentioned by Anthony on not mixing the implementation difficulties of a principal standard with the complexities of some transactions which are complex in their nature. And of course also some caution expressed against looking back again into control, because this could be disruptive a few years after the implementation.
Anthony.
I just want to point out an observation. Actually, quite a few have mentioned about changes in the nature of the interest in both directions, and then also the ASBJ work on saying where there is perhaps no literature or it's not clear what you do on the change. You know, I'd actually apply Linda's lenses from earlier on. You know, it isn't just whether or not there's any literature; it's whether when there is literature and there's a movement, tells you how to deal with that transition, is it actually relevant information, and also what is the cost and complexity of that. So I think it probably is almost a mini theme in itself, looking at each of those possible transitions and just considering, you know, applying Linda's lenses from earlier on.
I think you make a good point, because some of these transactions, some of these gaps have been filled over time. It is possible that the focus has been on individual type of transaction rather than trying to develop a more general framework about treating this kind of passages. So,
yeah, just one more point, if I may. I think I would be interested, prior to any decision, in an assessment about joint arrangements in practice. How many do we have? How do they develop? I have the feeling that in a U.S. environment, there is more of a straightforward line of control in general in businesses, while in other jurisdictions, you know, joint arrangements are more on the agenda because for business reasons people tend to cooperate, create new structures that are a bit less controlled, and where there is possibly a level, I wouldn't say of ambiguity, but of discussion, of dialogue between the various stakeholders. And therefore, an assessment of the playing field would be of interest, because we need also at standard setting level to reflect a reality of the arrangements. And if some reflections are depictions are not satisfactory, then we create a problem for those arrangements to prosper when they are needed.
Can I respond? Just a comment here. So I think it's true that in the U.S. we have a legal discipline as to how we document the formation of ventures. And I think it's very clear when it comes to ownership that we have a legal environment that makes that perfectly clear. But when it comes to some collaborative arrangements or some of the joint operating types of transactions, I don't know if it necessarily is any different in the United States as it relates to the complexity, because you still can have a number of circumstances where you have a pharmaceutical company and they're working with someone that's actually developing a drug, and then there will be a distribution arrangement. They may not form a legal entity structure, where we do have a very disciplined legal structure, but their actual commercial contract may not follow a set format. So I just wanted to offer my thoughts in reaction.
Yeah. What I'm interested in is an assessment, you know, again, to have a look at it.
Okay, that's it.
If there are no more comments, thank you very much.
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you. May I share some quick comments based on the feedback that we received from the Chinese stakeholder? Firstly, in general, we believe that these three standards have been well implemented in China. Secondly, we agree that the most questions have been identified in the agenda paper. The stakeholders in China think that this is also their concerns. Thirdly, I just like to highlight three areas based on the feedback from stakeholders. They show some about the judgment when implementing the three standards. First one, about the substantive and protective rights. Second is about the principle of agent. Third is about the judgment on whether a multiple arrangement is a single transaction or not. So that's their preliminary comments. Finally, we will continue to follow up the implementation of the three standards in China and do more outreach and seek more feedback from all stakeholders. And we would like to share our more comments in the future. Okay, that's it.
Thank you.
Sorry, I'm not sure I catched up all the three points. You mentioned substantive and protective rights, connected,
yes.
Connected transactions. What was the third one?
Principal agent.
The principal or agent.
Agent principal. Okay, thank you.
The third one is judgment on whether a multiple arrangement is a single transaction or not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments?
No. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
If any moment you want to reach out to the team, please do.
Okay, then we will bring forward the discussion on the agenda planning. So, Deha.